Avakha Show. We're looking forward to learning Lost in Translation. Maybe you can put it into proper translation for this. Okay, Vakasha.
Thanks. Right, so we are now on to the Targums, the earliest translations into Aramaic. And last week we looked at the Septuagint, the Jewish authored Greek translation, but we said that that became very important in the Christian world, but was really lost to the Jewish world, partly because of changes of language and partly possibly because of its identification with early Christianity. But the Targums are still very much part of Jewish tradition, and we do still use them. Maybe not quite in the way they were meant to be used, but we certainly use them. So this is moving much more into a sort of Jewish central idea of translation, what it might be and what it might not be. Now, this set of translations, we know very well that it actually started as oral translation. And why was that necessary? Because Jews are not really speaking Hebrew anymore. So we need a little bit of historical background. Most of the Judean population was exiled to Babylonia. That's today's Iraq, bits of Iran, bits of Turkey, bits of Syria. In 586 BCE, when the Babylonians invaded, burnt down the temple, burnt down most of Jerusalem, and conquered the whole of the kingdom of Judah. That's the first Tisha B'Av. And they marched off hundreds of thousands of people. They didn't just do it to Jews. They did it to anyone they conquered. There's nothing personal about it, really, as a good way of subduing local populations. And the Jews lived in Babylon for the next 50, 60, 70 years, depends quite how you date it. A first wave came back in 539 BCE when the Persians conquered the Babylonians and more or less said to all their captive populations, you can all go home now. And then another wave went, a sort of second Aliyah, if you like, around 480 BCE with Ezra and Nehemiah. And we don't know, probably a lot of people trickled back on their own steam, you know, small caravans with a few hundred people or what have you. So when they came back, it was notable they weren't speaking Hebrew anymore. They had acclimatized linguistically to the Babylonian context, and they were speaking Aramaic, which at the time was one of the three official languages of the Persian Empire. The other two were Elamite and Old Persian, should you want to know. Now, Arabic isn't a huge jump because it is quite close to Hebrew. And those of you who have struggled with Aramaic will know that familiar feeling where one in 10 words you can actually understand, the other nine, not so much. But it works on the same three-letter root principle. And there are a lot of common roots. There are also a lot of terrible pitfalls where something looks similar and doesn't mean the same thing at all. But it is not a million miles away. But even if you're speaking Aramaic and you understand it fluently, one thing you're going to have trouble with if it's your first language is understanding the Torah, because the Torah is in Hebrew. So clearly, this was a problem. Well, we have a trace of this already in the book of Nehemiah, which describes what we think is the first ever public Torah reading. And we all see as we read it that some of it looks very like what we do in Shul today. Not all, but some of it is familiar. And there's an interesting verse at the end that may reveal oral translation, presumably into Aramaic. So we'll look at this passage and then we'll look at that last verse particularly. And this is the first source on source sheet. There we are. No, wrong one. Let's get right back to the beginning. There we are. Okay. So on the first day of the seventh month, Ezra the priest brought the law, the Torah, in before the assembly, which was made up of men and women and all who were able to understand. He read it aloud from daybreak till noon as he faced the square before the water gate. This is in Jerusalem, in the presence of the men, women and others who could understand. I take that to mean sort of older children, but not quite clear. And all the people listened attentively to the book of the law. Ezra the scribe stood on a high wooden platform built for the occasion, very like our bima and shuls. Ezra opened the book. All the people could see him because he was standing above them. And as he opened it, the people all stood up. Again, a bit like Hagbah. Here it's happening before the reading. Okay, it's fine, I didn't do that. Ezra praised the Lord, the great God, and all the people lifted their hands and responded, Amen, Amen. This sounds faintly like Baruch Hu. Then they bowed down and worshipped the Lord with their faces to the ground. Okay, we don't actually do that anymore. All right. The Levites, whose names I'm going to leave out, instructed the people in the law while the people were standing there. And here's the verse that's really interesting. They read from the book of the law of God, making it clear, and the word is meforash, and giving the meaning, som sechel. And then this translation, which is JPS, says, so the people could understand what was being read. What it actually says is not quite that. It says at the end, vayavino bamikra, and they understood the reading, which is a little bit briefer. But this word, meforash, is interesting. And what it's clear that the Levites are doing, even if we don't quite understand absolutely every last nuance here, is that they are going among the crowd and they are explaining and translating and interpreting for the people, something like that. And this may be the origin of what we know as Targums, of Aramaic translations. We know they started orally. Maybe this is how they start. And certainly the Talmud Yerushalmi, the Jerusalem Talmud, understands this word and this passage in that way. Let's have a little look at that text. And the Talmud says, what is the scriptural basis, minayin, for the Targum? How do we know this stuff is allowed, that they're doing it shul? Rabbi Zeira said in the name of Rabbi Hananel, quoting Nehemiah, and they wrote, read from the book of the law of God. That refers to scripture. That's the actual reading. Making it clear, that's meforash, this refers to Targum. And giving the meaning, som secher, this refers to the accents. I'm presuming this means, well, actually, I don't know if it means the laming accents. I'm really not sure what that act means at all. So the people could understand what was being read. And then this is not easy at all. I'm going to ignore this last bit, because what we're interested in is the idea in the Jerusalem Talmud that meforash explicitly refers to Targum activity. In other words, to translating it into Aramaic. So that's interesting. Is that historical proof? No, but it's very suggestive that that was certainly what was understood later on. And given the fact, you know, that Targum was still being done as oral translation, you know, that's quite suggestive. We also have laws for how this was done, and they are encapsulated in the Mishnah, which tells you exactly how the Matur Gaman, the oral translator, should actually work. And it tells us the reader of the Torah may not read less than three verses. So an aliyah can't be less than three verses. Okay. He may not read to the Matur Gaman, the translator into Aramaic, more than one verse at a time. Okay. So he's got to stop after every pasuk, every verse, and he's got to wait for the Matur Gaman, and it literally means translator. A targum literally means translation in Aramaic. He has to wait for the Matur Gaman to put that into Aramaic. Then he can read the next verse and the Matur Gaman will translate. Then he will read the next verse and the Matur Gaman will translate. It must have taken forever. In the prophets, luckily, when you're doing Haftorah, he cannot read more than three verses. So you're allowed to read three verses of the Hebrew of the prophets, and the Matur Gaman summarizes. Then you can do the next three verses. Clearly, accuracy or precision is not quite so necessary in Haftorah. Then they go on to say, if the three of them were three passages, they read each one of them. That's actually not very important for us. They may skip in the prophets, they may not skip in the Torah. In other words, you leave bits out in Haftorahs, which we do still. Some Haftorahs actually leap. And if you're following them from a Tanakh, you get a surprise. How much may he skip? Until the Matur Gaman may stop. And that's interesting. In other words, you read, as the reader, your three psukim, your three verses from Haftorah in Hebrew. The Matur Gaman gets going on his oral translation. You continue reading under your breath. There was no silent reading in the ancient world, so this would have been, he would be going mumble, mumble, mumble. When the Matur Gaman stops speaking, you can skip that where you've got to. At that point, you can skip that much and just choose the next verses, because that's what you really wanted to say. This again reflects a time when Haftorah was quite fluid and hadn't sort of, you know, got bolted down the way it is now. So that's also interesting. And we have another text from Megillah that shows that not all passages were considered suitable for translation. It's mostly to do with sex. Not surprising, really. And our next passage in Megillah records that. The incident of Reuven is read but not translated. So you have to read it. It's in the Torah. This is the bit where Reuven sleeps with his father's concubine. Again, a lot of our mafarshim going to, you know, to have to go in all sorts of directions to try and make this okay, but that's roughly what the pshat says. The incident of Tamar is read and not translated. That is Tamar who seduces her father-in-law when she's told to wait to marry for his third son and doesn't get given to him in marriage. So again, we have unit sex involved. The first account of the calf, that's the golden calf, is read and translated, But the second, the one in Dvarim, is read but not translated. Enough, we should hear about bad things we did once. We don't want to go on and on about it. So we leave the second translation out. And then it has some other things. The Kohanim's blessing and the incident of David and Amnon are neither read nor translated. Very odd, because we do read the Kohanim's blessing these days. But maybe there was a practice not to read it out loud, only to have the Kohanim read it. Not quite clear. David and Amnon, that's again in Nevi'im, so we'll forget about it. And there are a couple of other odd things that say, for instance, they don't read the Haftorah in the chariot. That's the first chapter of Ezekiel, which actually we do read as a Haftorah on the first day of Shavuot, probably because Rabbi Yehuda permits it. And then there's another Haftorah. We don't use a certain passage that is quite negative about the sins of the people of Israel. So the principles here seem to be, we have sort of a slight censorship. We don't read stuff to do with sexual stuff that doesn't seem appropriate. We don't read stuff about Israel's sins that might get us down or make us feel, you know, or remind God how much we have sinned. So we tend to miss those things out. But clearly it's an institution that needs rules. And this is roughly what was happening at the time. It was universal. Every shul had a Meturgaman, maybe two. And we know that they're around. We actually found a couple of Targumim written down very, very early among the Dead Sea Scrolls. So we found one for Iyov, which is interesting, and we'll come back to that one, and one for Vayikra. So clearly from fairly early on, they were being written down, but their prime function was to be read in shul. And we actually have this this practice still goes on in some Yemenite shuls, I'm told, where boys learn to read Targum like they learn to read Torah. Everywhere else, it died out in the Middle Ages, because really, what was the point? You know, it made the reading twice as long. Or what was the point in reading out a translation that now nobody could understand anymore? You know, it just wasn't any point. So they dropped it. But Targums also seem to have been used for individual study in Bati Midrash and in schools. And that may be the value of the Dead Sea Scroll copy of the Targum of Iyov, because Iyov is never read in shul for any purpose whatsoever. Therefore, if you have a written down Targum of Iyov, it implies somebody needed it to study it. They wanted to read the book. They perhaps didn't understand the Hebrew completely, and they needed a Targum to make things clearer for them. So we seem to have this dual use, both out loud and orally, and that was the prime function in shul, and also perhaps increasingly, who knows, as a study aid for people who would like a translation. And we also see that it was people were expected or to have access, or certainly scholars were expected to have access, because we have a little line in the Babylonian Talmud. Rabbi Hunas ben Yuda says, in the name of Rabbi Ami, a man should always complete his parashiot together with the congregation. In other words, you should go home and read the parsha that was read that week in shul, twice the Hebrew text and once the Targum. Shnaim mikra ve'echad Targum. So you should read the whole thing through twice in Hebrew and then read the Targum to make sure that you understand it. Some people do still do this. Interestingly, as people's abilities in Aramaic declined somewhat, and it's really by the Middle Ages, it's only scholars who know Aramaic at all. The Shulchan Aruch tells you that it's fine to use Rashi instead of Targum. So again, there are many people who do actually do Shnaim, Mikra, and Echad Rashi, and will read through Parsha by Parsha, as well as hearing it at Shul. So that's obviously good practice. So you can see that we've got a sort of continuous use of Targum. I mean, Shulchan Aruch is 16th century, so you know, this is still a thing that has to be ruled on, because people want to know, what do? I don't actually read Aramaic. Okay, so as I said, we're not clear on when the Targum were first written down. And to complicate matters, unlike the Septuagint, there was never one single version. They were not standardized. They all seem to have come from the land of Israel originally. Some of them, like Targum Onkelos, that we'll come back and talk about, were later used and edited and messed around with in Babylonia. And Jewish Aramaic in the land of Israel and Jewish Aramaic in Babylon were different. They're different dialects. So if you got something written down from the land of Israel and you were using it in Babylon, you might very well modify it to make it sound like your sort of Aramaic. And there's evidence of this editing and change of Targums. It just goes on and on and on. So weighing up our evidence from Qumran, those very early written ones, the actual features of the written Aramaic that survived, and parallels in interpretation with other early texts, like commentaries by Philo, biblical asides by the historian Josephus, and actually even the New Testament, it has been suggested that written versions of Targum Onkelos, at least, on the Torah, and Targum Yonatan on the Nevi'im, might have existed in the early second century, about the time of Bar Kokhba, might already have had availability of written texts of these very major books indeed. But they could go on evolving and changing because they weren't as holy as the Torah of the Nevi'im. They were not sacred books as such. They were study aids or reading aids. So there was nothing to stop scribes who copied them making improvements and saying, well, that must be a mistake. I'll change that. Or, well, nobody uses that word anymore. I'll substitute a more recent word or something like this. And basically, there is no one single text of the Targum. So we talk about the Targums because there are several of them. Some of them vary enormously. And rather like the different books of the Septuagint, some of these translations were pretty literal and some were not literal at all. Some incorporated all sorts of extra bits and pieces, and we'll have a look at some examples. And they vary a lot. So the more restrained ones, the ones that are more what we would think of as translation, include Onkelos. The Targum Onkelos, the most famous one, is mostly pretty close to the original. It doesn't do anything too weird. Here and there it has a little sort of departure from the path. But some of the other ones are very distant and incorporate a lot of other things as well. Some of the ones on Shir HaShirim, notably, and Esther, and the Neophyte Targum that we'll talk about in a moment again. So the other interesting thing here is when they add or they interpret or they read something in an interesting way, many of those themes and ideas and motifs and stories also appear in Midrash. And they also appear in the non-legal parts, the Agadic parts of the Talmud. And people sometimes sort of think, did they copy out of the Targum? I think it's generally accepted that none of these types of Jewish literature copied exactly from each other, but that these ideas were out there. These ideas were known to everyone or known to scholars. So we see them in different texts that overlap in time. The same interpretations or understandings come up again and again and again. And it's not so much that somebody went and found a manuscript to the Targum and thought, oh, I'm going to put that into a Midrash. It's just, it was out there. It was part of general knowledge. And if you want to look at that sort of world, the books of James Kugel are really, really interesting about this sort of alternate universe of how people understood the Bible in early days, which is reflected in later Jewish texts. So what were the Targum meant to be? It's clear they were meant to make the sacred texts available to people whose Hebrew wasn't up to the original. But perhaps they weren't meant as translations in the sense we use that word in the modern world, which is, I want to know what the words of the original say, put it in my language for me, and then I have an experience that is like reading the original as close as I can get. Rather, the Targumim seem to be much more... the Targumim seem to be much more like a sort of translation combined with interpretation. Not so much what do the words say, but what do the words mean? And this is why they're not as literal as we might expect from that word translation. I don't think anyone in the ancient world really thought of translation in the way we do. Like, don't put extra bits in. They wanted to know what it meant. So, if it didn't correspond word for word for the original, it didn't matter. The person who'd written it was telling you what the text meant, which is what you wanted to know. And so it makes us think about what translations do and what they're intended for and what sort of translation we are looking for when we're considering that too. And it highlights the question that we mentioned a little bit in the first session of how you translate. When do you take a metaphor or an idiom literally? When do you give the sense? So the very well-known one, I think you mentioned it, Vayicha Av, which actually means, and his nose became hot. It is a metaphor for he became angry. When would you translate it as his nose grew hot? When would you say he got angry? Well, it might depend. We have other things. Totafot ben enecha, which we know from the Shema. Nobody quite knows what totafot are, but whatever they are, is that a metaphor? You should treasure these words as though they appeared in some little something between your eyes. Or is it literal? Yes, you should build little boxes with the text in and wear them on your head between your eyes. What about ayin tahat ayin, an eye for an eye? Is that meant to be literal? Most people would say, no, that's a metaphor. It's the monetary value of an eye for the monetary value of an eye, etc. So we can see that even with our automatic reactions, sometimes we're treating some phrases as literal and some phrases as metaphorical. So that boundary shifts over the years, and it's not always the same at all times and in all places. And that we see in the Targum, because sometimes, again, a metaphor will be translated literally, or something that we're used to being literal is actually translated in a metaphorical way. So that doesn't necessarily match what we think of these days as translation. So the best way, I think, really, is to think of them as a very, very early form of commentary. And that's interesting because it links onto that word meforash, which, of course, is linked to our word peirush, which we use to mean a commentary. So I think the better way to think of Targumim is not as translations, but as early commentaries that also cover the whole text itself. And this is why they continue to be important in Judaism. If they were just Hebrew into Aramaic, like, who cares? We don't understand Aramaic that much today. Because they include interpretation, they are still a source for understanding Tanakh. And we see this, for instance, in Rashi. Rashi made extensive use of Targum Onkelos, and he refers to it over 400 times in his own commentary. He sometimes disagrees with it, but it's his first port of call. If he doesn't understand something, he'll go off to Targum Onkelos and he'll say, well, the Targum says it's this. You may then discuss that. Okay, so let's go on to what Targumim are there, and I've put a little table here. We will discuss some, but not all of these. And I put the name of the Targum here, this set of books it covers here, whether it came from Eretz Yisrael, that's EI is Eretz Yisrael, or Babylonia, and what it's like. So Onkelos, the most famous one, is on the Torah, and only on the Torah. It came from Eretz Yisrael, but was reworked in Babylon. It generally, as we said before, it's generally literal. Targum Yonatan is only on the Nevi'im. Again, it comes from Eretz Yisrael, is reworked in Babylonia. Then we have something odd that we're going to have to talk about, Pseudo-Jonathan. Targum Yerushalmi is its proper name. The Pseudo-Jonathan tag comes because somebody at some point saw the letters Tav Yud for Targum Yerushalmi and read it as Targum Yonatan and decided it was the missing bit of Yonatan on the Torah. But there is no Yonatan on the Torah, so that's why it's Pseudo-Jonathan. It isn't really Jonathan. So you'll sometimes see it called that. Sometimes you'll see it called Targum Yerushalmi. And that's a very flowery one with all sorts of crazy stuff. Neofiti we'll talk about in a moment. Again, only recently rediscovered in 1956. And that is interesting. And then we have a whole set. We've got bits and pieces from the Karaganiza, which actually are the earliest known manuscripts of Targum, apart from that one from the Dead Sea Scrolls. Something called the Fragmentary Targum, which only comments on selected verses and doesn't do the whole thing. And then we've got the ones on the Kituvim, which I'm sure you were wondering where the Kituvim in this list. It keeps saying Torah Nevi'im, Torah, Torah, Torah. There are Targumim on the Torah, on the Kituvim, but not for Ezra, Nehemiah, and Daniel. Why not? Because chances of those books are in Aramaic, and there's no point in translating Aramaic into Aramaic. So that's probably why we don't have Targumim for those. So let's go back and look at some of these. Onkelos, which is the one that, if you've heard of a Targum, it's going to be Onkelos. And it was the official Targum of Babylonia, even though it came from the land of Israel. And the Talmud calls it our Targum. And, you know, it's supposed to be their Targums, which we're not interested in. And it introduces phrases in the Targum of Onkelos with the words, we translate. So you can find quite a lot of Targum Onkelos quoted in the Talmud. It sometimes gets cited as evidence for halachic questions too. So it's already got a great degree of authority and importance by the time of the Babylonian Talmud. And onkelos, it's pretty literal, follows the text fairly closely. In halachic matters, it does agree with the Mishnah, which is good because not all Targums agree with the Mishnah at all. And they actually reveal there were different halachic understandings. So how do we know that it's, or what is this name? Onkelos. Onkelos is meant to be the person who wrote it. How do we know this? Well, our only evidence is the Talmud. Whether it's historical or not, we'll consider that in a moment. But the Talmud says, Rabbi Yemiyahu, and by the way, these names are important. Well, some say Rabbi Chia bar Abba said, the Targum of the Torah, Onkelos the proselyte, the convert, said it from the mouth of Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yehoshua. There's a couple of interesting things here. First, it doesn't say he wrote it. It says he said it, which goes back to that oral character of early spoken Targum. And also we have from the mouth of, again, there's that oral quality. They didn't go through his manuscript and correct it. They heard him and made corrections orally. So that's quite interesting because it gives us that oral basis. But there is a slight complication here. First of all, does this have implications for date? Well, it might. Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yehoshua are the generation before Rabbi Akiva, so they end the turn of the first, second century CE. Rabbi Chia bar Abba is quite a lot later. Okay, he's recording an earlier tradition. And again, Rabbi Yirmiyahu, it's a bit difficult to know which one it is. There are several. But we have a parallel passage from the Yerushalmi, from the Jerusalem Talmud, and this makes things a little bit difficult, because if you took this at first glance, you'd say, okay, Talmud tells us, like called Onkelos wrote it, he was a convert, and it was in the time of Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yehoshua. What does the Jerusalem Talmud say? Rabbi Yirmiyahu, same one, said, in the name of Rabbi Chia bar Abba, we had Rabbi Chia bar Abba, same bloke. Think so. Akilas, the proselyte, translated the Torah before Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yehoshua, same rabbis, and they praised him and said, Yof yafitim ibne Adam. Now, we'll start backwards. First of all, we'll investigate what is this quote, Yof yafitim ibne Adam, doing, and how does that mess up our story of Onkelos the proselyte writing a nice Aramaic translation? Okay, so Yof Yafitim Ibnei Adam is a quote from Psalm 45, and here it is. And that last, but we're only interested in the first bit, really. And that first bit has been translated in this New International Version as, you are the most excellent of men. Okay, Yof Yafita is clearly from the root Yafe, nice, good. Yof Yafita, you have done very well indeed, most excellent of the Bnei Adam, of the human beings. But there's a pun. You might remember Noah has three sons. And you might remember, along with Shem and Ham, there is Yefet. Already we see Yafita, Yefet, there's a link. Yefet is seen by the rabbis as the ancestor of the Greeks and all of Greek civilization. So you can interpret Yof Yafitim Ibn Adam to mean you have made the best Greek translation ever, or your Greek is better than that of other human beings. Coupled with the fact that this bloke is called Akilas, which sounds a little bit like the name Aquila, and the evidence that we have that there is a Greek translation by Aquila the proselyte, and you have to start wondering, is this Jerusalem Talmud text about a Greek translation by a bloke called Akilas? Okay. In which case, what is this Babylonian thing up here? The Aramaic Targum of Onkelos may be the tradition of a Greek translation by Akilas the proselyte has somehow mutated over the couple of extra centuries in the distance between the land of Israel and Babylon into a bloke called Onkelos, who did an Arabic translation. Not really clear, but it certainly calls this slightly into question as to whether it's as simple a story as it looks in the Talmud. We do know, as I say, that the Aquila translation, which was made after the Septuagint, is known about, and it, I think fragments still exist. So that's one possibility. I couldn't possibly decide which, but it certainly puts his origin, simple origin story from the Babylonian Talmud a little bit doubtful. The other alternative is they were the same person, and both of them were Aramaic translations, but then you have problems with Yof Yafita. What's that got to do with anything? If that's about Greek Yefet, it just doesn't work here as a pun. It just has to be a general statement. Well, maybe it's a general statement, but that's not like the reference. Don't do general statements like that. So back to Talmud Onkelos. We'll never know who wrote it, probably. We said it was quite literal. It has features throughout the other Targumim share that make it not quite literal. So it has a lot of parallels to Midrash. We have, if people could just mute themselves, that would be great. Thanks. We have 185 parallels to Midrash just in Breishit of Targum Onkelos. And in that same book of Breishit, we have 47 parallels to the Babylonian Talmud. So you can see it's partaking in the culture of its times. It's drawing on this vast pool of shared knowledge that early rabbis and early rabbinic culture have about how to understand the Torah. In general, is there someone we could just
I'm working on it. I'm trying.
Thanks very much. So one of the things it does also is what a lot of Targums do is, and that avoids talking about God like a human being. It doesn't like anthropomorphic language about God. Now, of course, there's masses of it in the Torah. The Torah is not shy at all, saying God's hand, God's nose, and God grew angry, God came down. And the Targum tends to replace that, God's hand will become God's power. God's nose getting hot might be God's anger blazed forth. God came down might be replaced by God was revealed. So it tends to shy away from human-like actions by God. And sometimes it does this by introducing the memra, the word of the Lord. So it'll say, the word of the Lord did this. The word of the Lord that did that, which is, again, you could say it's keeping God's hands clean or keeping God's hands completely out of view. It distances God from action that looks like human action. And where the Targum Onkelos departs from the text in other ways, it's generally pretty subtle. Every now and then, it's absolutely fascinating. It introduces a new meaning by just a little tiny twist, and we're going to look at one of those. So here we have Breishit. So I'm just going to have to try and move something out of the way. There we are. Oh, no, it hasn't worked at all. There we are. Vayoma Hashem Elohim. Hen ha'adam hayaka echad mimenu, the da'at of the ra.
I need to finish this one.
Amalia, could you mute yourself? Because we can hear you. Thanks. So we're just going to look at that first half of the verse. And the Lord God said, behold, the human, ha'adam, has become like one of us to know good and evil. We don't need the second half. And the Targum, Va'ama Hashem Elokim, Ha'adam havi yechidi ba'alma, mine lemedatav avish. The Lord God said, behold, mankind has become unique in the world, able to know by himself good and evil. So you think, well, what's going on here? Because that doesn't mean the same thing at all. The human has become like one of us, says God. That's now has become unique in the world. That's different. And something seems to have been added on here. We've got to know good and evil. And here we have to know by himself good and evil. What's happened here? There's a problem, a theological problem in the Hebrew. When God says, behold, the human has become like one of us, there are two problems. Number one, us. Why is God talking in the plural? That's a bit of a, you know, unease there. We only want one God. He should be saying the human has become like me. And the other one is, how can humans be like God in any way at all? God is completely different from humans. And here is God saying the human has become like one of us. K Ata echad mimeno. So that's a second theological problem. What does the Targum do? It looks at that word mimeno. Now, those of you who have some familiarity with Hebrew grammar will know that mimeno can mean from us, certainly in biblical Hebrew, and it can also mean from him. We usually read this as from us. The human has become like one of us, because that makes sense. The human has become like one of him, however, means something else. One of him, ke'echad mimenu, the human has become like one of him, unique in the world. And the Aramaic reinforces this with yechidi, which means singular. So not that the human being has become like God in any way, shape or form. The human being has become a unique creature in the world. Why? Because that human creature can tell the difference between good and evil. And no other creature that God has created can do that. So from a problematic assertion that humans in some way have become to resemble God, knowing good and evil, just like God does, the Targum just twists that a tiny bit and says, no, God says humans have become equal, have become unique in the world now that they know good and evil, which is theologically a lot less threatening. And you could quite see why Targum Onkelos took this interpretation, because it solves two theological problems with one very reasonable explanation. And to give you an idea of how influential that interpretation of the Targum became, actually Rambam uses it in his discussion of free will, of the choice of good and evil. It has an enormous theological payload, and that interpretation of the Targum went on to be used by many later thinkers, because it provided the way out of that earlier problem. So that's pretty interesting to see that by sleight of hand, by this tiny difference, a whole new meaning is given to the original words in Hebrew. Okay, so we'll just discuss a couple of the other Targumim also. First of all, Pseudo-Jonathan. That, as we said, was really meant to be Targum Yerushalmi, but the tough Yud were misinterpreted by the first printer as Targum Yonatan and not Targum Yerushalmi. And the name has stuck, so you'll often see it called Pseudo-Jonathan. And it's definitely not literal. The whole thing is almost twice as long as the Torah, which tells you right there there's a lot of extra stuff in it. And it's a mix of traditions from different times. It's been altered and edited and embellished and re-edited. It was probably finally edited around the 7th century CE. And how do we know that? It has a very remarkable feature where it seems to mention Arabic names, all of whom are related to Muhammad, the founder of Islam. We're going to look at that bit. Here is Breishit again. This is the story of Ishmael. And he, Ishmael, dwelt in the wilderness of Paran. His mother took for him a wife out of the land of Egypt. Now, there's nothing here about a reread. There's an insertion. This is what Targum Pseudo-Jonathan says. And he dwelt in the wilderness of Paran. Okay. And he took his wife, Adisha. Some manuscripts have Khadisha. And he divorced her. And his mother took for him Fatima as wife from the land of Egypt. Well, none of that is in the original. You can see this is an insertion, an addition. The interest here is the name Adisha sounds very like Aisha, one of the wives of Muhammad, or like Khadija, another of the wives of Muhammad. And Fatima was the daughter of Muhammad. So why are they in here? Not quite sure, but midrashically, Ishmael is often identified with the Arabs, and later midrashically, after the rise of Islam, Ishmael is identified with Muslims. And this may be putting in extra support for that identification. I can show you that Ishmael is actually the ancestor of the Muslims, because look, these were his wives' names. And you hear the Muslims talking about them all the time. This is the real version. Something like that. We don't know. But it could give you some evidence as to the date of the Targum, or the final version of that Targum. Another one that we're not going to actually look at an example of, but Targum Neophytes has such a good story I have to tell you about. I'm going to go back to the chart so you can see we're talking about this one. Very early. But as I said, it was only identified in 1956 by a Spanish scholar called Alejandro Diaz Macho. He found it in the Vatican Library. It was miscatalogued as Targum Yonatan, but it's not Targum Yonatan. And it was presented in 1587, this manuscript, which is the only manuscript known of it, was presented to the library of a rather sinister institution called the Collegium Neophytorum. And that was a Catholic college for converts from Judaism who were training to be priests. Now, that closed down in the 19th century and the Vatican bought their library. That's how it ended up there. What's it like? It has a lot of additional material. We might, if we have time, we'll have a quick look at it a bit later on. But that's a fascinating story because you don't find a completely unknown Targum every Monday and Thursday, and it was quite a turn up for the books. We talked briefly about the Cairo fragments, important mainly because they're the earliest known manuscripts of a Targum, except for the Dead Sea Scroll ones. And we talked a little bit about the fragmentary one. We're not really going to cover that or the Kituvim. But I would like to look at Targum Yonatan, which is on the Nevi'im. And again, we've got these questions about authorship and who actually wrote it. It's a bit like the counterpart of Onkelos. Onkelos is on the Torah, Yonatan is on the Nevi'im. And again, our ideas about who wrote it come from the Talmud. And here we have the Targum of the Nevi'im. Yonatan ben Uziel said it from the mouth of Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. Well, you might be familiar with those names. They are prophets, and they're in our Tanakh. But that's a bit of a surprise, because those prophets all lived in the 6th, 5th centuries. That seems a little bit early for somebody to be writing a Targum, or even saying a Targum. A little bit odd, and it contradicts other rabbinic sources. So I didn't bring them all here. But Avot de Rabbi Natan, a fairly late work from 4th, 5th century CE, says that this Yonatan ben Uziel was a pupil of Hillel. Well, Hillel was much later than these prophets. Hillel died about 10 CE. And in a couple of other places in the Talmud, it seems to associate him again with Rabbi Yirmiyahu and Rabbi Chia, as with the Onkelos story. And that would mean much, much later. The other suggestion that has come up in the academic world is, again, that we're talking about a Greek translation, not an Aramaic one, because there is a Greek translation by somebody called Theodotion. Theodotion means gift of God. Yonatan means gift of God. Could it be the same person? And then, again, the Babylonian Talmud has got to be muddled between Greek and Aramaic translations. Not sure. Less convincing, I think, than the Onkelos Achilles problem we discussed before. So basically, we don't know. It's a little bit more imaginative than Onkelos, but that usually sticks fairly close together. And again, we'll look at it in a moment, a sample. Last of all, what about the Kituvim? And as I said before, they're not discussed so much, but there is an interesting idea preserved in the Talmud that they should not be translated into Aramaic. And here is the passage. The land of Israel was shaken about 400 parsot by 400 parsot. I have no idea how long a parsot is, but it's probably something like a mile or a kilometer. A divine voice went out and said, "Who is this who has revealed my secrets to mortals?" Yonatan ben Uziel stood up and said, "I am he who has revealed your secrets to mortals," presumably by translating books into Aramaic. "It is revealed and known before you that I did not do it for my own honor or for the honor of my father's house, but I did it for your honor so that disagreements should not multiply in Israel." This seems to be talking about his translation of the Nevi'im, because this text then goes on and says, "And in addition, he wanted to reveal the Targum of the Kituvim. But a divine voice went out to him and said to him, enough." What was the reason? Why can't he go on and translate Kituvim? Because they include the date of the coming of the Messiah. Which apparently is fine. If you know Hebrew, you're allowed to know it. But if you don't know Hebrew, you're not allowed to know the date and the style, which is interesting. What's also interesting is, well, if not Yonatan Ben Uziel, somebody went ahead anyway. And we do have most of the books, except the ones we mentioned, in Aramaic. And of course, early on, because we've got that one from Qumran, from the Dead Sea Scrolls. So I don't know that Talmud is trying to bolt the stable door after the horse has bolted, or what exactly is going on there. It's quite interesting. And again, there's no standardization on the Kitubim Targumim either. Some are very crazy and out there, particularly ones on Shehoshuim and Esther. And there are different versions. There are Western and Yemenite versions of the Targums. We'll have a little look at Shehoshuim. And it's been suggested that rather than having two groups of very literal Targums and not so literal Targums, it might be an idea to change that grouping and say Group A, this is an idea by Philip Alexander, Group A, you could pull out a translation from the Targum. The actual words are translated. There's just a lot of reefing around of extra bits. Group B, you can't actually pull out the translation. It's too tied up in the explanations, and there's no way you can do it. And we're going to look at this B example to show you what happens when a Targum sort of goes off the rails and stops being a translation and becomes almost completely an interpretation, in our modern terms, that is. Okay, so I'll look at two verses on Shehoshuim. This is chapter 5, verse 1. Dodi tzach ve'adom dagul merevava. Basic translation, my beloved Dodi is white or shining, tzach, and ruddy or red, ve'adom. Dagul, which is derived from the word degel, a flag, something that stands out and is noticed, here translated as preeminent, merevava, more than 10,000. Here is Targum Jonathan on Shehoshuim. Then began the assembly of Israel to speak of the praise of the Lord of the universe. And thus she said, that God who I do desire, that goes back to Dodi, my beloved, that God I do desire to serve, who in the day is wrapped in a robe white as snow, that links back to Sah, white or shining, and is occupied with the 24 books, the words of the law, the words of the prophets, and the writings. And by night he is occupied with the six orders of the Mishnah. The splendor of the glory of his face shines like fire. That is presumably linking back to Adam, red or ruddy. On account of his great wisdom and powers of argument, for he promulgates new decisions every day, and he will disclose them to his people on the great day. And his banner, and that must go back to the word Dagul, related to Degel the flag, is over 10,000 myriads of angels. There is our Revava, 10,000, who minister before him. That is not a translation by anyone's standards. That is an interpretation, a rather slightly wild and woolly interpretation. But that gives you a flavor of when a Targum moves away from what we would call translation into imaginative, almost midrashic interpretation. And it really does sound a bit like a midrash, much more than a standard Targum like Targum Onkelos. This is sort of Baroque Targum, Targum on speed. You know, this is Targum just doing crazy stuff. Let's look at a second verse to get another taste of it. And by the way, I wouldn't worry too much about understanding what's going on here, because I'm not too sure either. It's clearly a sort of a mystical vision of God. So verse 11, Rosho ketem paz, kvutzotov taltelim shchorot ka'orev. Basic translation, his head, Rosho, ketem paz, fine gold, kvutzotov, his locks of hair, taltelim are curled, shchorot, black, ka'orev, like a raven. Okay. What happens here? His head, Rosho, is the law, the Torah, which is more precious than pure gold, ketem paz. And his locks, kvutzotav, are the interpretation of the words of the law, and which are heaped up. So it's the other way. This is Tal Talim, and that's Kavut Sot, I think. Reasons and precepts. To those who keep them, they are white as snow. But to those who do not keep them, they are black, shchorot, like the face of the raven, ka'orev. So again, you could not make those little jumping off points, or I don't know, the place where you come in contact with the trampoline. You can't make this into a running translation. So both of these are type B in Philip Alexander's terminology. They are imaginative workings on a base text that don't really distinguish between translation and interpretation. It's just a smooth running text that bounces off the words in no particular connection of the original text and makes this accompaniment or harmony or decoration around them. Again, that's much more what Midrash does than any form of translation that we're familiar with today. To get an idea of the way Targums differ, we could go back to the very beginning of Bereshit, a text we've used before, and see what happens with these. So we're just going to look at the first five verses. Bereshit bara Elokim et ha-shamayim ve'et ha'aretz. I won't read the rest of the Hebrew, but it's there for reference. And Targum Onkelos, you'll see, is pretty close. Of course, we have to make allowance for the fact that we're reading the Targum in Targum. We're reading the Aramaic in English. So, you know, some of this is the style of the translator again. But I think you'll agree that this is pretty close to what we think of as the opening of Bereshit. In antiquity, the Lord created the heavens and the earth. Now, the earth was desolate and empty. That's obviously Tohu Vavohu. And darkness was on the face of the deep, and a wind from before the Lord was blowing on the surface of the water. The Lord said, let there be light, and there was light. When the Lord perceived the light to be good, the Lord distinguished between the light and between the darkness. So the Lord called the light daytime, while the darkness he called nighttime, and it was evening, and it was morning, one day. Yeah, pretty close. What about Pseudo-Jonathan or Targum Yerushalmi? At the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was out without form and void, as your tohu vavohu, desolate of people and empty of all animals. Don't know where that comes from. Not in the original. Darkness was upon the surface of the deep, and a merciful wind, didn't hear anything about the qualities of the wind in the original, from before God was blowing over the surface of the water. God said, let there be light to illuminate the world. Bit of an addition. And immediately there was light. God saw that the light was good, and God separated the light from the darkness. And God called the light day, and he made it so that the inhabitants of the world might labor during it. That doesn't have any base in the Hebrew. And he called the darkness night, and he made it that creatures might rest during it. And again, that phrase doesn't appear in the Hebrew. And there was evening, and there was morning, one day. And the end's all the same. So you can see, again, it puddles along sort of fairly straight, and then suddenly it takes a sideways explanatory move. And you can see the quality of those additions is to add an explanation to something that might be a little obscure. You know, why does God call make day and night so people can work in the day and they can sleep at night? Now we know. The third one we'll look at is the Neofiti, our recently rediscovered one. And here we have that Memra, the word of God, distancing God from action that looks a bit too like human beings' action. From the beginning, with wisdom, doesn't appear in the Hebrew, the Memra of the Lord, the word of the Lord, created and perfected the heavens and the earth. And the earth was waste and unformed, okay, tohu vavohu, desolate of man and beast, empty of plant cultivation and of trees, that is not in the Hebrew. And darkness was spread over the face of the abyss, and a spirit of mercy, again, mercy coming in, from before the Lord, was blowing over the surface of the waters. And the Memra of the Lord said, let there be light. And there was light according to the decree of his Memra. And it was manifest before the Lord that the light was good. This is so you don't have God seeing things. God saw the light was good in our version. It was manifest before the Lord, again, takes away from that human-like verb to see. And the Memra of the Lord separated the light from the darkness. And the Memra of the Lord called the light daytime, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening and there was morning. in the order of the work of creation, first day. And that's interesting because famously in the Hebrew, it ends with Yom Echad, one day. And there is a lot of interest in why it doesn't say first day, because the next days are second day, third day, fourth day, fifth day, sixth day. Why is this one day and not first day? The Targum here solves the problem by changing it. Yeah, first day. That's what it means. I've put in a modern translation just so you can compare. But you can see that each of those Targums is subtly different. Sometimes they share features. So the motif of no people and no animals. Again, we have no animals. No people, no animals appears in the Neophyte. And then the Neophyte adds more, empty of plant cultivation and trees, which we didn't see in Targum Pseudo-Yonathan. Then we have, for instance, in Pseudo-Yonathan, we have the reasons for God creating day and night. That doesn't appear in Neophyte. But we do get in the order of the work of creation, first day, which is a novelty. So you can see they juggle with some of the same motifs. Some of them have something that's special just to them. They mix and match, they include, they leave out. It all rather depends. The last one we'll look at, we'll sample Targum Yonatan because we haven't done that yet. Isaiah 6, this is Isaiah's great vision in the temple. Here's a modern translation. In the year that King Uzziah died, this is the biblical translation, okay? I saw the Lord seated on a throne high and exalted, and the train of his robe filled the temple. Above him with seraphs, each with six wings. With two wings they covered their faces, with two they covered their feet, with two they were flying, and they were calling to one another, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty. The whole earth is full of his glory." At the sound of their voices, the doorposts and thresholds shook, and the temple was filled with smoke. We're running out of time, so I'm not going to do the second half. Here's Targum Yonatan. In the year that King Uzziah was struck with leprosy, whoo, where did that come from? The prophet said, "I saw the glory of the Lord resting upon a throne, high and lifted up in the heavens of the height." A lot of expansion there. "And the temple was filled by the brilliance of his glory. Holy attendants were in the height before him. Each had six wings. With two he covered his face so that he might not see." Explanation why he needs two on his face. "With two he covered his body that he might not be seen. And with two he ministered." So we have an explanation why they need six wings. "And one was crying to another and saying, 'Holy in the heavens of the height his sanctuary. Holy upon the earth, the work of his might. Holy in eternity is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is filled with the brilliance of his glory.'" So here we have an explanation why you have Kadosh, Kadosh, Kadosh. Those of you who say the section of the Siddur that starts Uval Etzion Goel, various times during Shacharit and also Mincha on Shabbat, you might recognize this because this Targum appears in the what's known as the Kedusha de Sidra. And we have the Aramaic translations there in the text. Next time you see it, you might go, "Oh, right, now we know where that comes from." But again, you can see the explanatory quality of this particular translation. So we'll just wrap up by saying that we can see that Targum isn't exactly what we would call translation today, perhaps. It doesn't necessarily mean to be what we call translation today. It's much more explanatory. It's much more what we call an interpretation. And when we get to looking at modern translations, Art Scroll is much more like the Targum than it is like a modern idea of translation. So it's quite interesting that we have this interpretation of what moving it into another language should do for you. It should, according to the Targum, tell you what the text means, not necessarily what it says. So it's quite interesting we have that impulse this far back in Judaism. It is a very, very real thing that borders. It's that uneasy line between translation and what we today would separate into interpretation. And it shows you that at the beginning of translation, they weren't necessarily two distinguishable types of writing. They were very much more interlaced than we would do today. Okay, I should have a quick look at the questions in the chat. It's interesting how quickly the Jews lost Hebrew. Indeed, given that Ladino was preserved, yeah, Ladino's not the best shape today. You have to have a culture to maintain it. So that might tell us something about the culture of the Jews in Babylon, that it was hard to maintain language. Traditional Yemenite synagogues, yes, mentioned that. With a triennial reading, the community has more time for Targum. Absolutely true. In the triennial reading, where you read the Torah over 3 years or possibly two and a half, was the custom of the land of Israel. So maybe that's why Targum really developed there. How does it differ from the reading of the Torah? The difference between Targum and Torah, in other words, Torah is in Hebrew, and you can't change the words. Targum is in Aramaic, and it's not fixed. You originally, probably every time that Meturgaman stood up and reread it in Aramaic or re-translated it into Aramaic, he might have used slightly different words each time. Later on, they get written down. But even then, they're not standardized at all. Is the Targum the translation of the Hebrew Bible into Aramaic? Yes, that's what we were talking about, Onkelos and all the others, exactly. Shnai Mikra is done for the parasha to be read on the coming Shabbos. Yeah, okay. Again, that's the way we do it. Is that what they meant originally? Not clear. Onkelos tends to literal. Yeah, we talked about that. Translating one as only doesn't seem to be much of a stretch, even in the English language. Yet in the one and only. Yes, was that in connection with the Bereshit one about Echad Meimenu? It's not really so much the Yechidi is sort of singular. It has a different connotation from Echad Meimenu, one of us, to Yechidi, which replaces that Meimenu bit. In other words, Echad Meimenu doesn't mean one of us, it means unique creature. And one of us is quite distinct from unique creature. Especially in the theological payoff there. It can mean singular, yes, but the theological payload, as I say, is very different in those two readings. They're very fine gradations of interpretation. If you want to understand how Targum works, you've got to see, you know, why do they think that was a different reading? What was the implication there? And we sometimes, we're so used to reading things in translation that we don't see the uniqueness of those interpretations and how they differ. They can sometimes differ by a hair's breadth, but that was a big deal to the people who were writing them. Okay, a pass through is 4 mil. Well, that helps enormously. I don't know. Is a mil a Roman mile? I don't know. No idea. Why do many Megillot routinely use a Targum like translation of Shir Shirim today? Oh, that's largely the influence of Art Scroll. We'll talk about the Art Scroll translation of Shir Shirim. Basically, sex became a dirty thing for Jews in the 20th century with the advent of Art Scroll. Before that, Jews thought sex was absolutely part of life and, you know, weren't averse to it at all. But Art Scrolls went all Victorian on us and went, oh God, we can't talk about sex. So you have this odd claim that, oh, there is no pshat to Shir HaShirim. It actually says that in the Art Scroll introduction. There is only an allegorical meaning. We don't want to talk about these things. We'll talk about that more, the fascinating letter by Rav Tendler, actually printed in the Art Scroll, completely contradicts that. How do the Jewish translators reconcile the plurality of nouns, us instead of him? Well, again, sometimes you'll find, but in particularly in Midrash, you'll find God talking in the plural referred to God addressing the angels. And that's a very common Midrashic device. Some people would cite the royal plural, you know, like we are not amused with Queen Victoria. But I think that is actually a later interpretation of why God might sometimes speak in the plural. The lack of vowels opens a huge gate for Midrash. Indeed. Okay, technically the word Elohim is a plural noun, indeed, which has, again, given rise to all sorts of interpretations. Are there any other questions that anyone's got that haven't appeared in the chat?
Feel free to unmute yourself if you'd like. Okay, I always wondered what would happen if we would introduce an English Targum into our laning today. Boy, there'd be a revolt. That would be it. That sure wouldn't last too long. But truth of the matter, it would make a lot of sense. It would make a lot of sense. Read it pasuk by pasuk. Whether you do the Art Scroll translation, whatever, it'd be kind of interesting. But anyways, thank you very much.
We do it in two ways, actually. First of all, we all have a written translation on our
right. So that's exactly correct. That's right.
And secondly, we often have a practice in many shuls of summarizing what you're going to hear. They'll do it sometimes aliyah by aliyah. So you could say we do have a sort of Targum.
Yes, I agree.
Reverse for us. You're absolutely right. Nobody would sit through it.
But it would be, you know, a formal Targum. People would go nuts. Although I would prefer that than any Misha Beiruchs. Maybe the time they waste on Misha Beiruchs, they can say on what's going on in the Parsha. Anyways, okay, thank you very much. For it to next week, 4 p.m. in England. for those who live in England. I don't know how many people we have from England here, but we'll be back to regular time around the world next week. Thank you very much. And tonight, 8:30, I don't imagine David Eisen, you're still around. I imagine you know to get up at 2:30 this morning. 8:30 p.m. this evening, Mark Shapiro, all our regular classes during the week. I will emphasize, we sent it on the email yesterday. We'll send it out going forward. Tomorrow's class, Rachel Danziger-Schransky, will be 11 a.m. Eastern, like it always is, the Eastern time, the first 5 p.m. in Israel. Wednesday, Rev Carmel's class will be 2:15 Eastern because he can only work 8:15 in Israel. So that'll be 2:15 Eastern instead of 1:15 Shir Bivrit. And on Thursday, Shuli Mishkin's also busy. So she has 7 p.m. in Israel, which means the Shir will be at 1 p.m. as opposed to 12 noon on the Eastern. It's a little, I don't know, it's confusing, but you have to just remember, we'll send up an email before each of the classes. But then next week, everybody's back to Eastern Standard Time around the world. So we'll be our regular 7-hour difference between the East Coast and Israel and 5 hours to London, England. Okay, thank you very much. We look forward to seeing everybody all week. Invite a friend. This week's Parsha Shir is being given by Rabbi Yitzchak Yat Shalom from Los Angeles, California, where it will be 5:30 p.m. on Thursday. But the beauty, the power of Zoom, you know, the world timing, you know, and the Gemara, they didn't know from this, by the way. That's a whole other discussion. The Gemara probably was totally unaware of time zones, but that's a discussion for another time. But actually, kind of now in Rosh Hashanah, came up in Daf Yomi, where, you know, the whole international dateline and all these issues, the Gemara probably thought the earth was flat. Most likely, the rabbis thought. In other words, we have no indication that they knew the earth was flat, which is, so what? I mean, no, why should that? I mean, you have anything to say on that, by the way? Am I totally off base?
Oh, I think you're probably absolutely right. But, you know, it's not a... It's just a matter of, you know, they didn't know.
Right. It was just that there was a nod, because there's never a discussion anywhere in Shas about differences because of the time. And there seemed to be indication that some of the discussions are based on the assumption that people living far away were observing at the same time, besides the whole discussion in Pesachim, where the sun goes at night, does it go under the earth? And so, you know, that whole discussion also seems to get, okay, that's, anyways, that doesn't matter. With the climate, it's always time to learn Torah. That's always a good time wherever you are. That's what some say, you know, by the way. Some say the reason their time changes, it can make it what you want. So there can be learning Torah 24 hours a day. Otherwise, if we only had the East Coast, who would learn Torah 3 in the morning? This way, when we're sleeping, they're learning in England. And that's why I've heard that interpretation in Yeshiva. It's a very nice thing.
We didn't have time zones in this country until we had the Transcontinental Railway.
I'm sorry, we didn't what?
We didn't have time zones in this. The concept of time zones in the U.S.
Yeah, correct. It was also right. It was by the sun. Right. It was by correct. We call it Eastern Standard Time because 12 noon was different at every time because we're totally insensitive to nature because we, you know, we don't work that way. The workday starts at 9 a.m. or 8 a.m. in Israel. We don't work that way. But of course, everything used to be done by the sun. You looked out and noon was not the same time. Just who cared what it was in New York? You lived in Toronto. Who cares? What does anybody in Toronto have to do with New York today? It's a global economy. So we have to, it's very important. I mean, right. I don't know when it started, but I don't think it's more than 100 years, 150 years, that the notion of standard time. That's what it means. Because noon, it's not 12 noon. It's not really. 12 noon is when the sun's exactly at the midpoint. But we say, at standard time, it's 12 noon. It's not the same in New York and Toronto, for sure. In England. So I don't know. Does anybody know when standard time began? I think it's within the last 100, 150 years.
I guess it's when telecommunications get good enough.
Yeah, that's right. It's as, you know, and
as was just with the railroads.
With the railroads, right. So that's basically the end of the 19th century, toward the last quarter of the 19th century.
If you had a timetable, people had to agree what time it is.
Meridian.
Right, I mean... The Gemara talks about Shabbos being on a mountain, being on a valley, so you perceive the setting of the sun differently. Anyway, all right, that's we can talk time.
Claudius Ptolemaeus, the time of the Gemara, it was certainly known that the world was round. Claudius Ptolemaeus lived around 200 ACE.
Right.
So the Rambam quotes him in his introduction to Perush HaMishnayot. He read him in Arabic. but he's reading Claudius Ptolemaeus. And the Rambam gives a diameter of the earth, which is remarkably similar to what we know today, because Ptolemaeus, sitting in Egypt, measured it. By taking 2 points, he measured the diameter of the earth.
It's, we don't know that the sages of Gemara knew about
that. Correct, correct. The fact that the Rambam knew that doesn't indicate. I'm assuming different sages. You can't say the sages of Talmud. There are probably some who did and some who didn't know, just like there are today. The rabbis today, Gedolei Torah, who know science, and Gedolei Torah, who they don't know grade four, you know, they don't know the basics. Whatever, I'm not passing any judgment. Obviously, everybody here comes from the world where we think it's important to study science. But there are many Gedolei Torah, know very little. I assume it was the same in the Gemara. There were rabbis who didn't have a clue how science worked and some who did. But there's no indication the Gemara really, there are indications of sugiyot in the Gemara where it's clear the rabbis did not know. Right now, but the Gemara is so many voices and so many hundreds of years and so many different things. You can't say the Gemara knew. Not everybody in the Gemara knew. Not every sugi in the Gemara takes into account that the world was flat. Was round. That's what I mean. Listen, we're getting into the whole controversy. You know, how much did the rabbis know about science? And that's an old controversy. But I also assume most people here come from the school that the school of the Rambam, that the rabbis were not expert in science. They were not experts in history. That's not there. It's nothing. Not chas v'shalom to grade one iota. They were experts in Torah and the Masorah. They weren't. They knew the science. Some knew the science of the time. Probably not all of them. Some, but you can't expect them to know more. They didn't invent. They didn't discover. You know, gravity. That wasn't the rabbis of the Talmud. That wasn't their role. Okay, it's late. Most people have left already because I don't blame them. But who wants to hear this stuff? But okay, those who want to hear, that's fine. Okay, have a wonderful day, everybody. Always interested to hear your comments, but I'm glad Samira liked it. So that's thank you very much. And okay, have a wonderful day. And don't forget to invite your friends. And we'll see you later on. Those are available at 8:30 tonight. Rabbi Shaul Lieberman, fascinating series of Dr. Shapiro continuing. And then tomorrow morning, Genesis and relationships. Okay, have a wonderful day, everybody. Time zones Fleming. I don't know what that means. Okay.
Sir Sanford Fleming invented
time. Oh, Sir Sanford Fleming. Oh, so that's...
Yes, and there's a school named after him that I went to on
Amherst. Yeah, that's already 20th century then we're talking.
No.
When did he die? I thought, no, he wasn't in 20th century. I don't know. I have to look it up. Okay, my knowledge of history isn't what it should be. Okay, what can I tell you?
All right, thank you.
I see. Okay.
Great.